Good morning, everyone. My name is Father Roger Landry.
Good morning.
I work for the Holy See's Permanent Observer Mission to the United Nations. I'll explain a little bit of what that is if you don't know. I am very happy to be here with you. I bear greetings from my boss, Archbishop Bernardito Auza, the Apostolic Nuncio and Permanent Observer to the UN. He has to be in Jamaica for the International Seabed Authority Conference this week. He wished that his trip to Jamaica was in January. It's in the middle of the July, but nevertheless, I'm happy to be pinch hitting. I'm here to speak about the global response to the refugee and migration crisis, and specifically about the work of the Holy See in helping to address it. As you may know, something historic happened on Friday. There was the informal adoption, the approval of the Global Compact on Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration. This is the first international agreement of best practices and goals and targets with regard to migration that we have ever had. As you may know, in 1951, we had the Global Convention on Refugees that was updated in 1967. But for the most part, migrants themselves, who can overlap with refugees because a lot of the times they have, there are definitional issues so that people who are really refugees are treated as migrants, etc. Migrants were protected by international human rights conventions and fundamental human rights, but there was nothing specific with regard to migrants. And that has now changed. The formal adoption will take place in December in Marrakesh, Morocco. But it's a big step forward that the international community, for the first time, has negotiated an agreement covering the many dimensions of the international migration complicated issue in a holistic and comprehensive way. And that whole effort of these last couple of years was to put together best practice from around the world in the hope that national governments, NGOs, church-based groups, etc., all across will implement them. But before we get into that, I'd like to give you a little bit of a background on the diplomatic work of the Holy See. Just in case you're unfamiliar with it, it'll be brief, but the organizers thought it would be a good idea. First, Holy See is a term that confuses people. The Latin is Sancta Sedes. It basically means holy chair. In the ancient world, authority was symbolized by a chair. Teachers would sit down, all students would stand as they took notes. Within the church, we celebrate the chair of St. Peter. He pronounces his most formal teachings ex cathedra, literally from the chair. And so the term to express the authority of the Pope from the earliest days was Sancta Sedes. He has an authority that's holy. Everybody else has some other type of authority. Now that was developed in the 4th century, and most people had no problem understanding that authority ecclesiastically. But once Constantine legalized Christianity with the Edict of Milan in 312, the popes and the bishops and the church assumed juridical authority, legal authority throughout the empire. For example, Constantine didn't want Christians suing each other in civil courts, forbidden by St. Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians. And he said, the bishops are real leaders. What I'm going to do is I am going to have Christians settle their disputes before the bishop or before his judicial vicar, but I'm going to give civil effects to those decisions made by them. So he made them essentially magistrates, judges, civilly. As the church grew institutionally and more things were given, the popes likewise had administrative authority, and more lands came, and the greater the authority grew, they needed to have police forces in order to settle disputes, all the rest of it. And so over the course of time, the civil authority of the popes grew, and that likewise was included in the Sancta Sedes, the Holy See. One of the most famous examples from the early church happened in 452. Attila the Hun was coming down toward Rome, annihilating everything in his warpath, and the vestiges of the Roman Senate, 42 years after Rome had been sacked by Alaric, went to Leo the Great and begged him to try to save Rome. They knew that nobody else had any civil influence. And so they asked him, and he went up to Mantua, and he went into a tent with Attila, and Attila came out and he said, "Gentlemen, we're moving north." Now, it wasn't public exactly what happened inside of that tent. The early Romans started a rumor that when he went into that tent, Leo said, if you're going to get to Rome, you have to come through me, Attila, and if you're going to come through me, you got to go through these guys. And Attila looked up on top of Leo and he saw Peter with the knife with which he had cut Malchus's ear, and St. Paul with the sword that had chopped off his head, basically saying, "You've got to go through us too." If you've ever been to St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican and you look all the way to the back on the left side, you'll see the tomb of Leo the Great, largest marble sculpture of the last 500 years, showing this very scene. What likely happened inside that tent is Leo promised a tribute, more or less taxes, if Attila let Rome survive, and he did. But regardless, you see right then the power, not just sort of exaggerated influence, but the power with which those in civil society began to look at the papacy. And so around that same time, the Pope started to send out their representatives all across the world. At first they were called apocrisari, a Greek word more or less for emissary. Then they were called legati or legates. Eventually they were called nuncii or proclaimers or announcers. But all were essentially doing the same thing, representing the Pope ecclesiastically and civilly. Modern diplomacy started really in the 13th century in Italy. All these city-states started to have economic arrangements among themselves. Because there were papal city-states at the time as well, they caught on to it and started to send these representatives that were more or less like consuls general today, focused on economic stuff. It continued to grow as these representatives were exchanged. Then the Protestant Reformation happened. Prior to the Protestant Reformation, at least ecclesiastically, the Pope didn't have to send a legate to Germany most of the time because you had bishops there in Germany. But after parts of Germany and other parts of what used to be a united Christendom in Europe started to pull away and go Protestant, now yet still had all of those civil jurisdictions that you needed to concern yourself about, and the Pope would send these nuncii to these various countries. At the same time, you see how the papal civil jurisdiction grew when what we would now call South America was being explored. There were huge disputes between the Portuguese and the Spanish. In order to settle it so that they wouldn't have to have a war, they went to the Pope as the arbiter. So again, he was exercising these civil influences, which were very important for the world. French Revolution happened. Napoleon did something extraordinary for diplomatic history. He basically violated every diplomatic custom imaginable. He was confiscating all of the diplomatic pouches to try to get intelligence. All that was always considered sacrosanct. Likewise, he was just running bulldozers over diplomatic immunity, trumping up charges in order to get... It was a tough time. So in 1815, the international community came together at the Council of Vienna and formalized a lot of the diplomatic protocol that we still have today. One of the important aspects of the Council of Vienna was it said that a country can always choose who the dean of the diplomatic corps will be, so whom the president would speak to, or the prime minister or the monarch, if there were any dispute with anything, so that the message would get out to everyone else, or who would speak on behalf of the entire diplomatic community to that local representation. And the Council of Vienna said the de facto default is going to be the Apostolic Nuncio. Why? Because we were everywhere. And also we were above sort of military concerns above a lot of the economic concerns that other sort of diplomatic work was. And so in many of the countries of the world still today, if they haven't chosen another country to be the dean of the diplomatic corps, or don't do it by seniority, it's always the Holy See, which brings everybody together, which gives us an exaggerated emphasis in international diplomacy. 1870 was a big year in the history of papal diplomacy. Garibaldi in Italy, Garibaldi for Italy, united Italy by suppressing the papal city-states. And so much like Poland between the Council of Vienna and the end of World War I, even though there was still a Holy See, even though there was still a Pope with this international authority, there was no physical territory corresponding to it. Poland, likewise, was off a map between 1815 and 1918. There was still a Polish nation, but there wasn't a recognized Polish country. What happened at that point? Still, the representation across the world grew. Many were sending ambassadors. The influence was augmented, but there was no territory there corresponding to the juridical personality. Up until 1929, with the Lateran Accords, when a small little part of Rome was given extraterritorial status, given over to the Holy See to be the geographical circumscription. That area was called the Vatican. It's a term that goes back to 400 BC, talking about the Etruscan seers in that area across the Tiber where you'd now find St. Peter's in the Vatican City-State. And then the last stage in this quick little sort of journey is what happened with the world wars. After World War I, we recognized that the system of international alliances was very harmful for the world. You fight with one person, you bring all these other countries in, as we saw when Franz Ferdinand was murdered. You needed to have some way in which disputes were able to be handled without bilateral and then multilateral explosions. So we tried it with the League of Nations. It failed, but the idea was still there. And as World War II was going on, there were these conversations about something that fixed some of the issues with the League of Nations, and they were proposing to call it the United Nations. And that's what was founded at the end of June in 1945 in San Francisco. The Holy See at the United Nations is just the second thing in intro. In the preamble of the United Nations, they say that the United Nations exists for four things. And those of you who know Catholic social teaching very well will recognize how much this dovetails with Catholic social doctrine. First is to prevent the scourge of war. The UN was founded to prevent World War III. The Church has been fighting on peace issues and to prevent war, trying to be children of our Heavenly Father through becoming true peace, not wishers, but makers, since Christ gave us the Sermon on the Mount. And so, first pillar was something very much condigned to our emphasis. Second, human rights and human dignity on which they're based. Again, something that we have fought for. Third, development in general and the alleviation of extreme poverty, something that the Church in all the continents has been doing from well before the United Nations was even an idea. And fourth, observance of international conventions, international law, treaties, etc. And even back in the 5th century, the popes were writing about pacta sunt servanda, this Latin aphorism that said treaties, agreements need to be kept, they need to be observed. And so the Church, when it looked at the idea of the United Nations, was very sympathetic. At a practical level, when Pope Pius XII was looking at it in 1943, he saw two massive issues with the United Nations. First, an organization that purports to equality among nations was going to be patently unequal with the five members of the Security Council that will always have a veto. The United Nations wouldn't have been founded if either the Soviet Union or the United States of America thought that they could lose the Cold War just by a deliberative vote. So the way to get them both to the table was to give them a veto to say that, at least in terms of international security, anything you don't want won't happen. But Pius XII, the brilliant diplomat that he was, saw that eventually that veto would be used for national interest rather than international common good. And that remains one of the biggest problems for the United Nations to this day. The United States vetoes every resolution that comes on up, for example, with regard to Israeli settlements in Palestinian territories. Almost everyone is 14-0-1. That was December of 2016, or 14-1-0. 14 would vote to condemn those settlements. The U.S. would vote against it, and that veto works. President Obama abstained once, and that's when it passed, and will never be brought back. But the U.S. routinely veto, for example, anything with regard to Israel. Likewise, Russia. So many of the issues in Syria have come because Russia will constantly veto any real investigation of the atrocities of Assad, chemically bombing his people, etc., if it has any teeth to it. And so, huge issue, second huge issue Pope Pius XII identified was there's no real enforcement mechanism for any of the resolutions of the United Nations. And his concern was that the United Nations would just become the world's most prestigious debating society. And sometimes that's what it seems, because the only real enforcement is national honor. You've given your country's commitment to implement the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, to implement the Global Compact for Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration. But what a lot of, you know, in the church, successors are also heirs of what came before. There's an inheritance, there's a continuity. In a lot of governments, there's not. Donald Trump, for example, as we've seen, has no real burden to follow a lot of the agreements that Barack Obama himself got into. So there are issues here with regard to the efficacy of the United Nations. But conceptually, the church was very much there. The church, even though we weren't a permanent observer until 1964, was constantly asked to participate in these major meetings because of the infrastructure of the church throughout the globe. So we participated in the 1951 Refugee Convention and the Special Committee on Refugees. UNESCO, the first permanent observer to UNESCO in Paris, his name was Archbishop and then Cardinal Angelo Roncalli, the future John the 23rd. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the Food and Agricultural Organization, the Law of the Sea. And there was an auxiliary bishop named Bishop Griffiths in New York who was following the situation in the Middle East, China, and the early population control movement for the church. In 1964, the Holy See became a permanent observer just by an exchange of letters. Permanent observers don't exist in the UN Charter, but there were only 51 countries when the UN was founded because the Security Council wouldn't let any country that had done business with Axis during World War II join. If they couldn't give money and they couldn't give troops, they were not permitted to be members, but they wanted them to show up and hear, and eventually they'd figure it out. So at any given time, there were up to 18 different permanent observer states. And when the Holy See became a permanent observer in 1964, there were four others at the time. Eventually, 2002 happens. Switzerland becomes the last to withdraw. And so the UN came to Pope John Paul II and said, what do you want to do? Do you likewise want to become a member? Took 2 years for him to deliberate. He decided to retain permanent observer status so that there'd be a neutrality when it came to a lot of the debates. But he asked that the UN formally define what permanent observer status means. So in a resolution July 1st of 2004, it said, permanent observer state, the Holy See can do everything every other state does at the UN with three exceptions. We can't run for office, so the Pope will never be permanent observer. Sorry, Secretary General. Second, we can't initiate resolutions, but we can co-sign them. But we can always get lots of other people to initiate anything that we want. Third, we can't vote on resolutions except when, for example, with the Global Compact, it's an all-states formula in which we can. But most resolutions are never voted on anyway because they're worked out in consensus so that everybody just accepts them by acclamation. So we're there capable of negotiating just like everybody else, and because we've got a neutrality, we've got an exaggerated influence, in my opinion. There were five papal visits to the UN. Paul VI came in October of 65 at the Secretary General U Thant's begging, because the UN was about to die 20 years in. It wasn't really accomplishing much. He came in and gave an incredible pep talk. One of the things that he said, very influential, very important for us, is that the UN tries at a political level to do what the church does at an ecclesial level, at a spiritual level, to serve all people everywhere. And so he drew some parallels between what the church has learned and what the UN was learning. John Paul came twice. Pope Benedict came in 2008. And I was already president of the UN when Pope Francis came in 2015. I helped organize that visit. The popes have come, and essentially their big time messages have been, if the UN didn't exist, it would have to be invented. But just like the church, which is always in need of reform, the United Nations is semper reformanda as well, always in need of reform, rooting out corruption, making sure that people are served far more efficiently. Let's now get to the topic at hand, the Holy See and migrants and refugees. There's a huge background that inspires our work. Abraham, of course, left Ur of the Chaldees and needed to find another place at God's sending. Joseph was basically kidnapped and brought into Egypt, and eventually Jacob and his whole family followed. Moses and the Israelites escaped and wandered in the desert for 40 years with no place yet to call home. God, based on that experience, said to the Israelites, "You shall not..." there's a typo there, I'm sorry about that, but "you shall not wrong, thank you, a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." Nice to have an ex-Protestant with us. No, just kidding. You have the whole experience of the Babylonian exile, where people were forcibly deported. The Holy Family itself were refugees fleeing from the sword of Herod. And Jesus personalized it all, saying, "I was a stranger and you welcomed me." I like to say, with regard to the church's diplomatic work, that it is our way of living out Jesus' call to be salt, light, and leaven. In particular, with refugees and migrants, this salt, light, and leaven is urgently needed. Church teaching on refugee and migration. Just a very brief survey. Pius XII gave us the first real focused document on the situation of refugees. In Rerum Novarum, Pope Leo XIII had talked about it somewhat obliquely. In Pius XII, he goes through taking all the sort of little crumbs that his predecessors had given and puts it into one big document to both address the international issues as well as to get the whole church mobilized. St. John the 23rd afterward in Pacem in Terris likewise talked about the refugee and migration crisis. At that time, it was still ongoing after World War II. One of the big issues was in the Refugee Convention in 1951, it was just for everybody from Europe before a particular date. So the church recognized there were plenty of other refugees who weren't living in Europe before January 1st, 1951. And so Pope John the 23rd helped lead to what was the 67 Protocol to expand the definition of refugee to anybody in the circumstances that had been previously defined, but all over the world, no matter what the date would be. Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution of the church in the modern world, talked extensively about migrants and refugees. Every year since 1976, the popes have written a message for the World Day of Migrants and Refugees. And over the course of time, particularly with John Paul II, he really started to give a lot of teaching there, continued by Pope Benedict, and very much taken seriously by Pope Francis. We'll see some of Pope Francis' words a little bit later. And there are local churches all over who have likewise contributed to this social magisterium, like the U.S. and the Mexican bishops. In 2003, this pastoral letter, "Strangers No Longer, Together on the Journey of Hope." Almost everything in that pastoral letter is still very valid today, 15 years later. It's almost as if, with the exception of some of the numbers of those making the migratory journeys and everything else, almost everything is still very timely in what it wrote. What's the international situation and the response? In 1948, the international community approved the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in Article 14 of it, it recognized the right of persons to seek asylum from persecution in other countries. When you can't live at peace at home, you've got a right to leave. We'll develop that as we go along. The 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees, which entered into force in 1954, referred to European refugees before 1951. Eventually, as I mentioned, in 67, it started to apply to everyone. But nothing, as I mentioned at the beginning of this presentation, was done about migrants in general. Although many of their fundamental human rights, protected by the UDHR and subsequent conventions, were being violated in the same way that refugees' rights were being violated. But nothing was done until the present day. We likewise know about the recent crisis and the ongoing need, not just at our southern border, but across the globe. In 2015, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees said that there were 65.3 million refugees, asylum seekers, and internally displaced people worldwide. That's a big number, and for those of us who sort of try to get our hands around the US debt in the trillions, it doesn't really mean much. But to break it down a little bit, that means one out of every 113 people in the globe is a refugee, asylum seeker, or internally displaced because of a lack of peace. It's gargantuan. Every minute, just another way to look at it, every minute, 24 people around the world flee their homes because of violence or persecution. In the course of our time, about 1,800 people, just during my talk and your questions, will have to be on the move because they can't stay where they are. Extraordinary magnitude. The UN Department for Economic and Social Affairs, DESA, says that as of 2017, there are 258 million people living in a country other than the one they were born in, which is one out of every 30 inhabitants on Earth. Of those, just a few other figures, 26 million refugee and asylum seekers, with 84% of them in low and middle income countries. So the vast majority of those countries that receive refugees are low or middle income. The median age of refugees is 39. Almost half are women. Sometimes we think that it's just all young Muslims from Syria who are on the move, who are going to sort of be involved in local cells. I mean, it's an incredible lie. 50% are women. 2/3 of all international migrants live in just 20 countries. Half of international migrants live in just 10 countries. And the largest number, almost a fifth of the total, close to 50 million people, are resident in the U.S. So the U.S. by far receives more migrants than any other country. In terms of continents, Asia has the most, 80 million, and Europe is second with 78 million. What's the international response to this situation? It's been in various stages as we've gotten closer to trying to help out migrants. First is the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, passed the day the Pope spoke at the United Nations. And, you know, just for those of you who work for the church all throughout, and thank you for that work, what everybody recognizes at the United Nations is if the Pope weren't there that day, almost nobody would know about the Sustainable Development Goals. And likewise, everybody's begging the Pope to go to Morocco in December for the official signing of the Global Compact in order to bring the attention of the world with him. The technocrats at the United Nations grasp very clearly that they do, for all their expertise, they can't mobilize the world. They can't motivate the world. And so there's a great opening now after sort of this process of humility, I call it, to what faith-based organizations not only can do, but are doing across the world. In the Sustainable Development Agenda, Preamble 35 was all about the economic benefits that come from international migration. So many of the things that ended up in the Global Compact were summarized in that preamble paragraph 35. And then there were four separate targets all related to international migration. A year later, there was the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants, which was the international community's way in response to the massive crisis of saying, we've got to do something systematic. You know, in the United States, we're always talking about comprehensive immigration reform. This was the international community's recognition that there has to be comprehensive immigration reform at a global level because it exceeds one country's capacity to be able to manage it. And so, in addition to getting a lot of the ideas down there for the first time in international documents, it called for two global compacts. One on refugees that would be internationally consulted under the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva. Consulted because there were already these conventions, and they just wanted to update the conventions in a sense with best practices across the globe for refugees. The last time it had been looked at, as you know, was 1967, so a lot can change in 50 plus years. Second was the Global Compact. So the draft for that was published June 26th, and it'll be brought to New York by the UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, and then the international community will discuss it, and we'll see what happens, whether it's Marrakesh or anything or anywhere else where it's received by the international community. But then the second is the Global Compact for Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration, which was intergovernmentally negotiated in New York. So we had tremendous impact and input on what came on out there. The final draft was just approved on Friday, or approved informally, and will be adopted in December in Morocco. What are both of these? They're meant to make sure that the protection gaps for those on the move are closed, so that there's a seamless continuum protecting human rights of those who have had to leave their homes. And what the international community recognizes is that many de jure refugees are treated de facto as migrants, because a lot of the countries just don't want to classify them according to their refugee status that they should really be placed in. And so they find themselves in situations of irregularity, and anytime there's irregularity, there's great vulnerability. Exploiters can take advantage of all of that. What's the Holy See's response to this crisis? Pope Francis, this really is one of his most concerted efforts. He visited Lampedusa in July of 2013. We just celebrated the fifth anniversary of that. He wanted to go. The people around him said there's no time to prepare the visit. And it is a true story that he called the airlines himself so that Father Lombardi, the press spokesman, had to receive a call from Alitalia just saying somebody called saying he was Pope Francis and he wanted to book a flight down to Lampedusa. And that's where it all happened. I mean, he was just not going to take no for an answer. And then he went there. And in my opinion, even if he spoke for 25 years, he gave his most eloquent homily there in Lampedusa, where he basically said, "Have we lost the ability to weep?" You know, in that strait across the Mediterranean, in 25 years, 20,000 had died. 2 weeks before he came, at the end of June, pregnant women were drowning with their babies, 8 or 9 months pregnant, there in the Mediterranean, being crushed by boats against the cliffs on the southern side of that island. And he went on out and he told that incredible story from South American Spanish literature about how we all kill when we're indifferent to those who are suffering. And so Pope Francis wanted us to recognize that we really are our brother's keepers. And he awakened the conscience of the world, especially in Italy. Italy was very struck by this. He then went to Lesbos 3 years later with the Patriarch of Constantinople to focus on a united response, especially to the Syrian refugee crisis and all those fleeing into Europe. He established the Migrants and Refugees section of the Dicastery for Promoting Integral Human Development, and he said that he would be the superior of that section for the time being. He wanted to make sure that what they were proposing would actually be implemented, that it wouldn't have any of the typical Vatican red tape. And if you ever go to Italy and you've got any bureaucracy with a lot of Italians, the red tape is actually thicker. So Pope Francis wanted to make sure that he could cut through all of that. And so Father Cerny and Father Baggio, the two co-undersecretaries, regularly meet with the Holy Father to keep the whole ball rolling. He's given a few really important messages with regard to migration in 2017 to the International Forum on Migration and Peace. Then earlier this year, the message for the World Day of Peace, as well as the 104th World Day of Migrant and Refugee message. In all of these, he focused on four verbs. You involved in the work that you are probably know already what these four verbs are. But to welcome, to protect, to promote, and to integrate. We'll parse them as we go through. But rather than listening to me describe them, listen to Pope Francis.
Le migrazioni nelle loro diverse forme non rappresentano certo un fenomeno nuovo nella storia dell'umanità. Esse hanno marcato profondamente ogni epoca, favorendo l'incontro dei popoli e la nascita di nuove civiltà. Purtroppo in gran parte dei casi si tratta di spostamenti forzati causati da conflitti, disastri naturali, persecuzioni, cambiamenti climatici, violenze, povertà estrema e condizioni di vita indegne. La nostra comune risposta si potrebbe articolare attorno a quattro verbi: accogliere, proteggere, promuovere e integrare. Accogliere. Un'accoglienza responsabile e dignitosa di questi nostri fratelli e sorelle comincia dalla loro prima sistemazione in spazi adeguati e decorosi. Proteggere. Parliamo di milioni di lavoratori e lavoratrici migranti e tra questi particolarmente quelli in situazione irregolare, di profughi e richiedenti asilo, di vittime della tratta. La difesa dei loro diritti inalienabili, la garanzia delle libertà fondamentali e il rispetto della loro dignità sono compiti da cui nessuno si può estinguere. Promuovere. Proteggere non basta, occorre promuovere lo sviluppo umano integrale di migranti, profughi e rifugiati. La promozione umana dei migranti e delle loro famiglie comincia dalle comunità di origine, là dove deve essere garantito, assieme al diritto di poter migrare, anche il diritto di non dover migrare. Integrare. L'integrazione, che non è né assimilazione né incorporazione, è un processo bidirezionale che si fonda essenzialmente sul mutuo riconoscimento della ricchezza culturale dell'altro. Credo che coniugare questi quattro verbi in prima persona singolare e in prima persona plurale rappresenti oggi un dovere.
So that video was used by the UN at the very beginning of the last form of the preparatory work in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, in December, in preparation for the Global Compact 6 months of negotiation. So it gives you a little bit of an indication of just how prominent Pope Francis and the work of the Holy See is in the Global Compact that was just developed. Pope Francis's four verbs were developed by the migrants and refugees section into two elaborations. The first, 20 action points for the global compacts, and the second, for Catholics all around the world in parishes and in dioceses, 20 pastoral action points. It's based on these four verbs, developing what welcoming means, what protecting means, promoting, and integrating. They were developed in consultation with experts from bishops' conferences and NGOs across the world, including NGOs here, as well as the USCCB's experts. It's not exhaustive of church teaching, but provide useful considerations, not only to the drafting, negotiation, and adoption of the Global Compact, but also to dioceses and parishes to help the church better respond to the enormous needs. I'm just going to show you what was happening here, because when you look at the 20 action points and the 20 objectives of the Global Compact, you see a massive overlap. Likewise, with the four verbs and the four main principles of what was trying to be accomplished in the Global Compact's massive overlap. This was a foundational document that the co-facilitators used to develop the zero draft or the initial text of the Global Compact. Welcoming. It basically means increasing safe and legal routes for migrants and refugees, that there's no arbitrary expulsion of migrants and refugees, that we're not rejecting people. We're increasing legal routes for safe and voluntary migration. Just to even call it regular, which means legal, is an indication that when it is irregular, people are so much more vulnerable. It's not good for states, it's not good for anybody. But the present quotas across the world just are not sufficient. That's what the 20 action points is saying. Welcoming values each person's safety, dignity, and rights, and balances it with national security concerns. You know, about a month ago I was giving a talk, and somebody came up from one of the nations in Europe and basically was trying to defend his country's policy not to let in one Muslim. And I basically said, your culture is not strong enough to be able to absorb even one. And it got the person to pause a little bit, as one should. National security concerns are important, but they have to be balanced against person's dignity and rights. Protecting, this is the most elaborated part because there are so many violations of human rights across the world. To protect it, emigrants in their countries of origin, that the Holy See has stressed the right to remain comes before the right to migrate. You shouldn't be forced to flee where you were born. And there's so much that has to happen there so that people don't think that they need to flee, whether it's violence, whether it's persecution, whether it's endemic poverty. Protect immigrants in their countries of arrival. We would also say countries of transit. To empower migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees to leverage their skills, not to be taken advantage of as they come. To protect vulnerable, unaccompanied, and separated minors. This is a huge issue in our country, which has the capacity to be able to handle it. Some countries don't quite as much, but we need to set the example. Protect all underage migrants with special protections according to the international conventions. Provide access to education for all underage migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees. You probably know this, but the average stay in a refugee camp is 17 years. Imagine if you arrived at six in your next 17 years were there. Education in a refugee camp is so important. Education in any facility in which people are. We need to provide for this. Access to welfare, basic health care, social security plans for those who work. And ensure that migrants never become stateless. There are many who fall through the cracks. They can't get certificates in the countries that they've emigrated to, nor because they weren't born in their countries of origin, get it there. So they have no documents, which obviously brings with it a ton of problems. Promoting, which is fostering the integral human development of migrants and refugees. That you've got to value and develop the competencies of these, the great talents that they've gotten, the education that they've already had, the skills that they have. They can contribute a lot. Sometimes all they really need is some help in the language of the country in which they've gone, but to value and develop their competencies, to support social and professional inclusion, to protect and promote family integrity and well-being. This is so important for just overall happiness and also for the strength of societies which are being torn apart because of problems with the family. Treat persons with disabilities just like citizens with the same conditions. So hearing aids, seeing eye dogs, wheelchairs, etc. Increase international funds and support for receiving countries. Because as we see, so many of these countries are low and middle income. They need international aid if they're going to be able to care for so many. Likewise, the communities that change dramatically with a massive influx, those people likewise need to receive some type of service because their life has changed dramatically in welcoming so many. And assure the right to religious freedom so that we're not taking them out of a situation in which what's most important cannot be met. And so there's a specific call for those who are co-religionists to take responsibility for their co-religionists. Similarly, for everybody else to try to create possibilities for people to continue to worship. And then fourth is integration, which is greater participation of migrants and refugees to enrich local community. The church stresses it's a bidirectional process. It's not the same thing as assimilation. It's integration, where there's a mutual appreciation for the talent and gifts and cultural inheritances of the other. But refugees and migrants likewise have to accept where they've come and the good that's there. So they're going to try, the church says, if they're under 50, the church comments, to try to learn the local languages, to respect the various cultures, not to be disruptive, but to appreciate what's there, so that likewise their own cultural gifts would be able to be shared. Promote solidarity toward all those on the move, because so often fear is the narrative. And then to ensure repatriation programs for those forced to flee humanitarian crises. If they are able to go back and desire to be able to go back, we should facilitate that and make sure that what they've gained in their place to which they've gone is able to translate back. So from Social Security benefits to educational degrees to everything else. The Global Compact, where I'm going to spend 5 minutes and then we'll take time for questions to just go over it. The main structure, it begins with a preamble and a vision and guiding set of guiding principles. What do we see there in the guiding principles and in the preamble? That most migration is already safe, orderly, and regular. That migration has been a part of the human experience throughout history. But there is a need to recognize that something new has happened because of the numbers. That refugees and migrants are entitled to the same universal human rights and fundamental freedom, which have to be respected, protected, and fulfilled. The Global Compact, it says, is a milestone in the history of the global dialogue on international cooperation on migration. It needs to be respected in that way. Shared responsibilities, it lists four. To mitigate the adverse drivers and structural factors that hinder people from building and maintaining sustainable livelihoods in their countries of origin. Again, we've got to fix the developmental issues or the lack of peace issues that force people on the move. Reduce the risks of and vulnerabilities of migrants at different stages of the migratory journey. Again, here, protect address legitimate concerns of communities while recognizing societies are undergoing so many changes that have implications for and result for migration. Here, promote. Create conducive conditions that enable all migrants to enrich our society through their human, economic, and social capacities. Here, integrate. Very much in the structure, you see the echo of the 20 points. Guiding principles, there were 8 of them. People-centered, not policy-centered, not government-centered. International cooperation is essential. Can't be done by one country. National sovereignty. Countries have a right, as the Church has always said, to protect their borders, but not in a paranoid way. Rule of law and due process for all those on the move. Access to justice is fundamental. Sustainable development, both in countries of origin as well as in countries of destination. Migrants could play a huge role in sustainable development if we just set them up to succeed. Human rights, because the entire compact is based on international human rights law. Gender responsive. So the human rights of women, men, girls, and boys must be respected, understood, and addressed, because they can vary. We can't just have a one-size-fits-all. Child-sensitive. Existing international legal obligations toward the rights of the child must be upheld. And the best interests of the child must always be the primary consideration when we're dealing with refugee and migrant children. Whole government approach is the 7th of 8, that migration needs various government agencies, not just border control, for example. And a whole of society approach, that we need all players on the field, because it's not going to be able to be met in a holistic way without everybody getting involved. They had 23 objectives, then the commitments based on the objectives, focused a little bit on implementation, and then there's a setup for follow-up and review. You'll get this presentation, by the way, and I'll show you where to download it. In the 23 objectives, I just want to highlight a couple of them, which I think are important for us in our work in the church. The first few are all about data, so that we know the situation and can more properly address it. We've talked in the 20 points about legal identity and adequate documentation to help people, enhance availability and flexibility of pathways for regular migration, increase it. We need to make sure that fair and ethical recruitment and safeguard conditions to ensure decent work, so that people aren't hoodwinked for forced labor. To address and reduce the vulnerabilities in migration, to really know what they are and fight very hard to protect. To save lives and establish coordinated international efforts on missing migrants. That there needs to be this international cooperation across borders when people do go missing. Strengthen the transnational response to migrant smuggling. 10th, something that we work very hard on at the United Nations. Prevent, combat, and eradicate trafficking in persons in the context of international migration. Because so many of the traffickers mimic what the smugglers do. Manage borders in an integrated, secure, and coordinated way. Strengthen certainty and predictability in migration procedures for appropriate screening, assessment, and referral. In a lot of places, the church is very much involved with this. Here are some principles that we're trying to move the international community. Use migration detention only as a measure of last resort and work toward alternatives. This is detention for everybody, a fortiori children. But to treat migrants as criminals and slam them in jail is something that's not in accord with what they do. And a lot of the vocabulary is that way. Talk radio continuously talks about criminalians and the rest. At a practical level, enhance consular protection, assistance, and cooperation throughout the migration cycle. And to create the conditions for these smaller countries that don't have consulates in various countries to have some type of mechanism in order to be able to help the people on the move. 15, very important, provide access to basic services for migrants, education, healthcare, nutrition, accommodation, etc. 16, we're already seeing promote and integrate. Empower migrants and societies to realize full inclusion and social cohesion. Eliminate all forms of discrimination. And promote evidence-based public discourse to shape perceptions of migration. We've got to get the other narrative with the real facts that are out there of how much migrants contribute to the places where they go. Invest in skills development, facilitate mutual recognition of skills, qualifications, and competency to really help them get set up. There's a dentist, for example, great dentist, but she's from Italy and she can't get her competency quickly enough here as she moves in order to be able to do the work for which she was trained. So she's doing something much smaller than that. I remember in Rome when I was there for a student for many years, you had people selling trinkets and half of them had doctorates from Eritrea because they just couldn't work. These last are about facilitating the help that they're able to give back in their countries of origin. Create conditions for migrants and diasporas to fully contribute to sustainable development in their countries of origin as well as their countries of destination. That means promote faster, safer, and cheaper transfer of remittances and foster financial inclusion of migrants. Best practices are changing fast there thanks to new technologies. And the typical sort of 20% commission rate, which was something 15 years ago, has been dramatically reduced. The UN wants to see it down to 3% commission. Cooperate in facilitating safe and dignified return and readmission and sustainable reintegration when they want to go home. Establish mechanisms for the portability of Social Security entitlements and earned benefits. And then lastly, strengthen international cooperation and global partnerships for safe, orderly, and regular migration. This was just added in the last draft because we really have to keep that cooperation going. In the implementation, I just want to focus on this paragraph, which is, we'll implement the Global Compact in cooperation partnership with migrants, civil society, migrant and diaspora organizations, faith-based organizations, local authorities, etc. Recognize that so much of the work done on the ground is done by the people in the room. I'm not going to focus on the Global Compact for Refugees at all unless you have questions. And I finish with Pope Francis. He, in his message for the World Day of Peace earlier this year, said that the Migrants and Refugee section of the Dicastery has published a set of 20 action points that we covered that provide concrete leads for implementing these four verbs in public policy and in the attitudes and activities of Christian community. So not just in public policy, but this has to go into the formation we give people at every level. The aim of this and other contributions is to express the interest of the Catholic Church in the process leading to the adoption of these two global compacts. This interest is a sign of a more general pastoral concern that goes back to the very origins of the Church that's continued in her many works up until the present time. This isn't peripheral, in other words, to what the Church is. It's core. It's my heartfelt hope this spirit will guide the process that in the course of 2018 will lead the UN to draft and approve two global compacts. As shared agreements at a global level, these compacts will provide a framework for policy proposals and practical measures. For this reason, they need to be inspired by compassion, foresight, and courage. So we need to care for people. We can't be indifferent. We need to be provident. We need to look ahead to see what obstacles are there. But we also have to be bold, because there are a lot of obstacles and we need to persevere through them in the excuses so as to take advantage of every opportunity to advance the peace-building process. Only in this way can the realism required of international politics avoid surrendering to cynicism and to the globalization of indifference. And so the Church has a particular role in helping the international community not cave to the cynicism and global indifference. Thanks very much for your attention. A little bit later today, I'll upload this on CatholicPreaching.com if you'd like a copy of the note, minus the video, because you'd never download the video. It's too big, but you can watch the video on YouTube. We'll do that later. But we've got now...